my depression, I got through by finding purpose. And a purpose that was greater than my own life and my own depression. Then when I was injured, because I'd already had that purpose inside me, all I had to do was to find a way to get back to it.
To Voices from the Frontline, and this latest episode with my friend, the peripatetic, inspirational polymath that is Giles Dooley. Photographer, writer and presenter, not to mention compelling TV cook and the one-armed chef, he was also recently appointed UN advocate for people with disabilities in conflict. Born in 1971, he came of age during that brief window of optimism that heralded Cool Britannia, when he was busy photographing the then-considered demigods of society, such as Marilyn Manson, Lenny Kravitz and Oasis. When he tired of shooting celebrities and their antics, he changed tack, concentrating on documentary work that involved him standing on a landmine in Afghanistan in 2011. It cost him three limbs and almost his life. Today, he continues to train his lens on the fallout and aftermath of combat, and on the domestic, close-up and personal front lines of civilian lives. In 2016, he set up the charity Legacy of War Foundation, which has had a huge impact, helping communities post-conflict rebuild their lives. To me, Giles is a personification of a life lived to the hilt, rich in experience and hope. It's a privilege to have him here in the studio as we examine the troughs and peaks, an unstoppable trajectory of a man who has the drive to make a difference. Voices from the Frontline is a Cold House and Maker production in association with the Frontline Club London. It tackles the frontiers of human experience and ponders the lessons that can be learnt from those who operate in the far reaches. It's an extended, free-ranging conversation, an antidote to clickbait and surface-level thinking, bringing varied stories and opinions to life in long form. For more information on this podcast, please go to our website, www.frontlineclub.com, or follow us on Instagram, Catherine_Fairweather. The Frontline Club is a registered UK charity that champions independent journalism and freedom of speech. Giles, I really appreciate you making the effort to come here today. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, lovely to see you too.
I remember, actually, for the benefit of our listeners, the first time I met you, it must have been about 13 years ago, you were in recovery still, in a wheelchair, just out of hospital, I think, when you came to visit us in our tiny little cottage in Somerset, and we had trouble even getting you through the tiny front door, I think.
Yeah, I think I was just starting to use the prosthetic legs again. So I think I was just about kind of half and half using the wheelchair.
Yes, it was out of the wheelchair, onto your legs, yeah. And then into the house. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look at you now, racing around the world. 19 countries, I think, last year, wasn't it? Or you just told me it was six in Ukraine.
Yeah, it was six visits to Ukraine, but I think in the last 18 months, it was, 19 countries.
Yes, that time when you came to see us, it really struck me because you had just come out of this terrible time in hospital where you had nearly died after being standing on a landmine in Afghanistan and losing three limbs. I think only 20 people have ever survived that kind of trauma.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's the anniversary today, so it would be 12 years today that happened. It's funny, actually, I was writing something about it this morning on the train here about how with time, the kind of the memories fade. And I think when something just very traumatic like that happens to you, it dominates your life. And it's something that is bigger than you in many ways. And now, with it being 12 years, I look back on it and the memory is there, but now it's something very much in the past. But of course, that day will always, stay with me. I was out on patrol with some American soldiers. We were ambushed. As we were running for cover, stepped on an IED, which essentially is a landmine. And yeah, there was a moment, I didn't lose my consciousness at all. I remember the whole thing. And I'm lying there on my side, and actually it was in the tree. I could see bits of my legs. It was my shoe was up there. And, you know, I've seen, obviously, many people injured in similar ways and realized there's very little chance of survival. So I think there was a calmness, weirdly, and an acceptance of what had happened. You know, people have asked me, was it painful? I'm like, you're in a different place. It's something completely detached almost from any other experience you could imagine. And the biggest emotion I remember, if I have one thing that I would describe it as, it wasn't fear, it wasn't pain, but it was a sense of loneliness. Absolutely could never feel more alone than you do in that moment, which you think are the last moments of your life. But at the same time, it was, yeah, a beautiful day and watching the blue sky, but also thinking that I wasn't ready to die and it didn't feel like the right time. And I was lucky I had, you know, American medics nearby. They got tourniquets on me. We got an American medevac helicopter that picked me up. And interestingly, you know, you always see in every film is the kind of the flashbacks, and people in their last moments of their life have these moments of reflecting on their life. And I had the opposite, which was these flash forwards of thinking of things I still wanted to do. And there was two medics, Phil and CJ, on the back of the helicopter. And we had maybe 30 minutes chatting. And I remember that whole conversation. And obviously this incredible bond was built between us, thinking they were the last, you know, minutes of my life. But they were interviewed months later. And we obviously hadn't spoken since then because I've been in hospital. And when they were interviewed, they said it was really strange. Halfway through the journey, it was as if something very calm happened to him. And we saw his vital signs coming down and everything stabilized. And when I was interviewed about that same trip, I said halfway through is when I started having flash forwards about what I still wanted to do with my life and dreaming of the things that still lay ahead. So it's really interesting that going on in my mind had been seen by the medics trying to save my life as a moment when they knew I was going to make it.
Extraordinary.
You know, there's a sort of abstractness to it. And I think, you know, like, as Don would have known, there's a sense of inevitability of these things. You know, I think anyone that doesn't get injured or isn't killed doing this kind of work almost feels lucky. And so when it does happen, it's not unexpected.
But I think that's an element of your personality. From what I know of you, you're an incredibly positive person. Only you would see that moment as being lucky. I suppose you were lucky because you survived it, but you were also unlucky to step on a landmine. And I think your whole career since has been defined by your ability to take the positive spin on everything. I mean, I suppose a lot of people would have just given up and decided to turn their face to the wall. And as you said, you were looking, you were projecting forward.
Yeah, but I think that's the thing of, it's not really being optimistic or positive. In some ways, it's the opposite. You know, I had a whole life where I was very self-destructive, suffered a lot from depression, and in a sense, maybe often didn't feel challenged in life. You know, I struggled at school, I was held back a year, I didn't get a place at university, did fashion photography, was I guess, successful in the sense I shot for, you know, French Vogue and GQ here in the UK, but always was frustrated, thought it was a failure at it despite all my successes. You know, drank heavily, got into drugs by my late 20s, gave everything up, sunk into a very, very deep depression for a few years, really could see no purpose in my own life. And I think it sounds strange, but I think there are certain people, I think Don would be in that same category, that need challenges, need things to push against, to feel somehow focused. And, you know, I always struggled with what I would call normal life and you know, being at home, sitting with a partner, watching TV or something. My mind was always, but it tended to then go into a self-destructive mode where to escape from what I saw as normality, I would go into, say, alcohol or drugs or other things. When I started doing documentary photography, but most importantly, it being a humanitarian and trying to have some impact, I found some purpose with that. I think when I got injured, I remember in many ways saying to myself, well, you have to stop giving yourself a hard time now. It's like everything is going to be difficult. Everything is a challenge. Give yourself a break. So interestingly, my depression improved, which probably is why people saw the positivity. But people who know me for a long time, you know, saw actually a change in me, which was more about I found it easier to live as myself after I got injured than I did before. So depression had, it held me back so much. And when people say, how did you cope with the injuries? I'm like, actually, it was 20 years of battling depression gave me the strength to deal with the physical injuries.
So depression was worse than losing three limbs?
Yeah, because depression, I mean, I reached a stage, so in my late 20s, I walked away from fashion, photography, and music. I moved down to Hastings by the sea. I got a job in a bar and really spiraled over the next couple of years. My marriage fell apart. I sold my flat. I was drinking heavily, using a lot of drugs, and just really in a stupor. And I remember reaching a point when I couldn't really see any future for myself. And then at that lowest, sort of darkest point, wanting to just give myself a sort of second chance at life and trying to rebuild something, that's when I decided to focus on the documentary photography, but also started doing care work. And I found looking after somebody else was the first time I could see kind of positive and direct impact on someone else's life, and that gave my life some sense of purpose. So that, though, those periods, those years, and again, you know, saying I started coming out of it wasn't immediate, and it was 10 years of rebuilding a life and finding focus. And depression is such a difficult challenge because, you know, when you're injured, it's easy for people to kind of give you support and be around you. People don't know how to deal with depression. People struggle with how to speak to you. You know, do they do the kind of, oh, come on, just get yourself together thing, which is obviously not helpful? Do people just give you space? It's very difficult. And of course, everyone's depression is different. For me, I pushed everybody away. And, you know, we'd go for weeks and weeks without speaking to anybody or having anyone near me. And that makes it worse for the person going through it, but as I say, makes it very difficult for people to know how to cope with it. When you see somebody with a physical injury, it's easy for people to come and support you and to do things and to help you rebuild your life. People still feel very, you know, we speak about it much more, but people still very uncomfortable about depression. And also, I think we have to be honest that a lot of people don't see it as an illness. They see it almost like a choice. You know, the people, if you haven't gone through it, that self-destructive depression is very hard to understand how something like that really does take over your life.
Mm. And you just can't help yourself.
No, and you can't shake it. And you know, it was a hellish place to be in. It wasn't, you know, my life was collapsing around me and yet couldn't do anything about it. And as I tended to make me quite self-destructive. And that goes back to, you know, 14, 15 years old, I was self-harming at school. So I've always had a history of it. So, you know, weirdly, as I say, the experience of getting injured kind of kickstarted something in my brain and maybe in some strange way made life easier for me.
But how did you get yourself out of that depression and pick up the camera again?
So I went through my own personal therapy, which was I started writing to people close to me. I chose like about 8-9 people, my brother and a couple of people close to me, from school, all sorts of people, and would write every day. And I said, you know, you don't have to respond to this, but I need to explain everything that depression had made me hide my whole life. So that was part of it. So it was a sort of self-therapy. And as I say, it was the fact that I realized that what I'd probably been missing in my life as a fashion photographer and a music photographer was purpose. And being a care worker was the first sense of purpose, which was, you know, I had somebody, a guy called Nick, who had or has autism. Where he is on the spectrum makes it very difficult for him to look after himself, so he needs 24-hour support. And I realized that, you know, being around him meant his life was, I hope, a little bit better and was able to enjoy it.
But how did you make that step to being a care worker? What made you think?
That was completely one of those random things that happened. I was working in a bar and Nick's family was in there and they were talking to me and they had carers for him, but they were professional carers and they thought it'd be interesting to have somebody that maybe came and spent a few hours with him every day that was not from, shall we say, the medical world, and he liked music, and they knew my background as a music photographer. So the idea was really I'd be a companion for a few hours. And then it just worked. And then it sort of became 12-hour shifts, 24-hour shifts, and then it became a full-time thing. And as I say, it's those days when depression kind of holds you back and you feel you can't get up and you have no reason to get up, knowing that somebody else needs you gives you purpose. And that, I think, is my advice to anybody when you're going through those really dark times. And again, everyone's depression is different, but for me, it can become a quite selfish thing. It becomes something where you're so absorbed in what you're going through that it's very hard to kick yourself out of that. And so when you have something else that makes you get up. Even before that, I remember even having my dog helped, because he'd be, you know, needed to go out for a walk in the morning. And even that was something that helped trigger something in me that, okay, I have to get up to look after my dog. And then, as I said, having a job that meant somebody was needing my help. And then that led on to, well, what could I do with photography? You know, could I do photography in a way that wasn't about myself, wasn't about the ego of bands, wasn't about making money, but was about actually having a positive impact? And so really that's the kind of trigger for doing the photography I do now.
So that was that you took the humanitarian photography path, and that led you to Afghanistan, where you were embedded with a unit, an American unit, wouldn't you? And that's where the...
Yeah, I mean, the humanitarian photography I've been doing for about 6 years before Afghanistan, and it was very much, I didn't want to be a photojournalist. And so, you know, my work was never published in newspapers. That wasn't my interest. I always say I was an angry man with a camera. You know, I saw injustice in the world, and I thought photography was a way I could help with that. So I was based in Angola, DR Congo, South Sudan a lot, and doing stories that were then used for advocacy, that were used in parliament, that were used even in court cases. And that was my focus. And then I went to Afghanistan to do a story on Emergency, which is an Italian NGO, and to tell the stories again of injured civilians, something we didn't really see much of in the media. And that was always my driving force, was to say this desire to create change through my photography, but also being driven by my own curiosity, which is that if you're watching something like Afghanistan and you're seeing all these stories about British and American soldiers, but you're like, well, why am I not hearing stories of the civilians? Why am I not seeing that side of it? So that's what drives me to go to a place to do a story.
But where does this... What were you like as a child? I mean, this urge, this angry person wanting to tell a story. Did you have a particularly hard childhood?
No, I mean, I had my own challenges. As I say, I suffered from depression at a very early age. And I was self-harming at 14, 15. And so there was something in me that wasn't diagnosed at an early stage. I'm dyslexic. That wasn't discovered. I was told I was stupid at school. You know, I was held back a year. So I had a lot of problems that weren't really resolved at that stage. And they had led to a lot of anger and stubbornness in me that was, again, probably self-destructive. I've learned to turn my stubbornness into something positive. But a great example is at 15, I said to my parents, and I didn't have a very good relationship with my parents, and I said to them at 15, I said, look, I'm there's no point in me staying at school. I said, I'm not achieving anything. I'm not good at it. And secondly, I'm never going to have a job in my life. I can't work for anyone. I'm impossible, because if somebody tells me what to do, I respond really badly, even if I know they're right. And of course, like any parents, they were like, you're 15. A lot of people think like that, but you will have to, and you'll need A-levels in your life and probably a university if you want to achieve anything. So we fought over it a lot. And my stubbornness reached a point where I said, okay, I'll study. I'll do 2 years. I'll do 3 A-levels, but I'll never open the results. I said, if I open the results, you are right. If they stay in that envelope, you have to admit that I was right.
Please tell me you opened that envelope.
No, I never opened them.
No.
So I did my A-levels.
And you still don't know what you got?
No, and I had no interest. And the day I finished school, I moved to America, bought a van and drove around America for months and just did my own thing. And I've never had a job. I've never needed to show my A-levels. So, you know, one of the last things I said to my mum when I lost her was, I guess I was right about the A-levels thing. but I mean, that was a kind of stubbornness that prepared to actually study for 2 years just to prove somebody wrong. So there was that, but it was, as I say, it was self-destructive. And then I was lucky, you know, I was supposed to go to America on a sports scholarship. That was kind of what I was doing. Then had a car accident there, came back. I'm 18, 19 in hospital deciding what I was going to do with my life. And that's when my godfather passed away. And his widow, Nita, came to visit me. And Barry, my godfather, had bought a couple of things just before he passed away. And one was an Olympus OM10 camera, and another was Don's biography.
Wow.
So I read that, and I had never seen photographs really in that way. Like, obviously, I'd seen photographs, but never photographs that really moved me, you know, emotionally made me feel something. And so seeing Don's photographs made me feel something I'd never realized I could feel from photography. And of course, reading the book and the sense of an adventure and all the things he got up to, that's when I decided that's what I wanted to do. So I was lucky. Again, I would say to people, it's amazing how a small gift can change your whole life's direction. And so, you know, people will say to me, you're so lucky to know what you wanted to do in your life. And I'm like, yes, but it's also because you're out there and just something triggers that. And we never know what that might be that comes into our life. And so for me, it was a book and it was a camera. And I just fell in love straight away. And then I left hospital full of good intentions to become a photographer like Don. But I had friends that were in bands. And suddenly I'm hanging out with bands and you know, I'm on the road with Oasis and all the rest of it. I'm like, I don't really want to go to a war zone. I'm loving this rock and roll lifestyle. I remember, I think I was probably 19, my first or second shoot. And I went to Detroit to photograph a band called the Black Crowes. And they were the biggest kind of rock and roll band at the time. And I'm on their tour bus. Yeah, it's one of those huge, great, big old-fashioned tour buses. And the bass player's there drinking out of a bottle of Jack Daniels, like every cliche you could imagine. And he says, Giles, do you want a whiskey? And I thought I was going to get, like, you know, a little glass of whiskey. I was like, yes. And he just reaches down, picks up another bottle of Jack Daniels and just passes it to me. And so, you know, at 19, that's an amazing experience. I never assisted photographers, just went straight into it. And yeah, it was an amazing adventure. But as I say, I hadn't found my purpose. And I think that's the thing that saved my life, because having purpose helps you get through so many things. And so my depression, I got through by finding purpose, and a purpose that was greater than my own life and my own depression. Then when I was injured, because I'd already had that purpose inside me, all I had to do was to find a way to get back to it. Because if I could find a way, I suppose in my sense, to make my life feel useful, it wouldn't really matter whether people saw me as having a disability or I had pain or injuries. For me, the one vital thing was to have a life with purpose and a sense of use.
And self-determination, I would say, is probably the impetus, because all these things that happened to you were extraordinary, some lucky, some unlucky, but it was your self-determination. You grabbed the moment, you turned the moment into something. I mean, when you were depressed, you decided to pull yourself out of it and become a care worker. And the same after your accident, your incident. So with disability now, I think you've just been made UN envoy, global advocate for disability in war and peacetime. What does that mean? And congratulations, by the way, but what does it entail?
I mean, the UN role is an interesting one. I mean, the UN, you know, knows that I have challenges with the organization, but I think it's important to engage with organizations. And I've done a lot of stuff with the UN, especially around UNMAS, which is the demining kind of part of the United Nations. And really, the advocacy role is a platform for me to be able to firstly share stories of other people's experience, because when you look at the representation of disability and conflict, you will see very little of that represented in those organizations that stand for those people. And I think it's really important that the voices of people who are living with disability and injured in conflict are heard at the highest platforms. So that's the first role. And then the second is, you know, as well as my own experience, I have 20, 30 years of documenting people injured in conflict and have seen the challenges. And a lot of it is about communications, about bringing different organizations together. So I'm also there to shake things up a bit and try and transform. You know, we look at, as I say, for me as somebody with a disability, and I look at a lot of the big organizations, NGOs, UN organizations, and I don't see the representation of disability within those organizations. It's the same in photography. You know, if you look at like World Press Photo, how many of those images are of people with disability, but how many of the photographers are? Very few, if any. And while there's been great moves forward, for example, the representation of women in photography, that hasn't happened in disability. It's the same with UN organizations. You know, I want to push that agenda, which means that it's not just about people's voices being heard. That's obviously great, but that only means something if that leads for kind of transformative change within those organizations. So I've 3 years in that role. And yeah, for me, it's about being in the center of the UN and trying to create change from within.
Will you travel for them?
I will be. I mean, already, you know, obviously, I'm traveling to a lot of the places where the stories are. So it will always be connecting. So, you know, when I was in Ukraine, I make sure I meet up with all different UN representatives and help to bring communication through on that. I'll be heading off to New York next month to speak at the UN. And one of the most interesting things is sometimes during that 3-year period, I get to speak to the Security Council, which is an amazing platform. So I'd say for me, it's about being a storyteller, which is what I've always been. And I realized, you know, photography is storytelling. But I think in photography, often we're stifled in the sense of we make the photographs and then we hand them to somebody else and they decide whether they're going to be in a paper or a magazine. And I realized at a certain point that I had to be more in control of how those photographs and stories were shared. So something like this UN is a great platform to share stories.
I mean, you're in control of everything from the beginning. You direct your entire story from the beginning to the end, which is very rare, I think. Nobody gets to do that.
I mean, I don't do commissions. There was a phase. So obviously, you know, I started as an editorial photographer. So for 10 years, that was a great experience, working for the likes of GQ, Vogue, and amazing publications. But obviously, you're working there with editors, art directors, the press officers. There's a whole team of people. But I learned a lot about editorial photography. What I decided is that when I went into doing the humanitarian work, I did not want to have that direction from other people. I wanted to be totally committed to doing the stories the way I believed they should be done. But I also realized nobody was going to pay for me to do that. So I had a job doing, it was another care job, looking after somebody with multiple sclerosis in London. And he was supposed to have like 2 24-hour carers alternately. And I arranged with his family and him that I would do 6 or 7 weeks without a day off and then use the money to go away for a couple of weeks to do a photographic story. And because I was living as the caring job, I had no rent, nothing. So everything I saved, and then I'd go. And I did that for 3 years. And I virtually didn't have a day off for 3 years. And it was tough. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, that living care work. And he had sort of given up on life. So the curtains were always shut. It was a very dark, depressing place to live. But it gave me complete freedom in my photography. And after 3 years of doing that, my work was starting to get published. I remember the Amnesty Media Awards, which I've always respected. I didn't win it, but I was a finalist, one of the 3 final photographers. And I remember going to that awards ceremony and looking through all the other photographers, filmmakers, journalists, and all of them were kind of, you know, in the program had their name, but then the Times or the Guardian or Channel 4, whoever funded it. And mine was the only one that didn't have anything next to it. It was just my name. And thinking that I'd done that for this little bedroom where I was based doing care job. And for me, that was a really proud moment because I had taken exact control of how I wanted to do things. It had been hard. I'd given up a lot to do it. But that was part of rebuilding my life after the depression. And from that moment on, yeah, I've been so lucky that, yeah, I see the whole process now. So I'm commissioning myself. You know, every project I do is determined by me. I'm doing it the way I want to do it for as long as I want to do it in a way that I think is right. And then I'm putting it together and finding a way to get that story out.
And Giles, how do you cope how did you cope? And I think you probably still do cope. How do you cope with the physical? I mean, being a photographer is a very physical occupation, isn't it? The physicality is extraordinary, hard enough to get around when you're got 4 limbs. How do you cope with that, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I will say I was kind of lucky because I was always quite a lazy photographer. So I think if anyone was going to lose his legs, it's probably best it was me. Because I really was never like, you know, one of these kind of... Because it is interesting. You watch a photographer at work, they'll be like crouching, running into a corner, standing on a table, finding all those different angles. And all that's been taken away from me. And that, at first, you kind of puts huge limitations on you. And you have to flip that and you think, okay, I can't do that. You know, I can't be... If I wanted to be the best photographer in the world, you know, I want to be seen among the greats. So you feel like if I've now lost the ability to have all those different angles, if I can't run to get something when something's happening quickly, how am I ever going to reach that kind of level? You then have to go, okay, well, think of it a different way. Sometimes the best creativity comes out of restriction. Sometimes having limitations means you have to think in a different way. What am I really good at? Well, to be honest, I was never the best in terms of maybe the actual shots, but it's about my relationship with people.
Mm.
That's my strength. So work on that even more. So make that purely the focus. So I started, especially after my injury, doing a lot of portraits, which is against a white sheet. And it's eye level. I don't have to do anything. It's very simple. The hardest thing to make those photographs work is my connection with people. So that's something that I could focus on. And in fact, maybe my injuries would open up some corridors of conversation with people because they had gone through something similar. And I wasn't going through that thing, which I always felt uncomfortable about, of being, you know, somebody from the West who's come there. And even if you think you're doing the right thing,
white savior.
Yeah, you know, you're still able to walk away and they're not. Mm-hmm. Now people would see it and think, well, this person's gone through what we've gone through. And it has opened up conversation. So that's something my strength. So focus on that. And there was a point 3 months after my injury, which I always think of a really vital moment. And I went through the first 46 days where I could only communicate by blinking. So I had 46 days in intensive care where they were fighting to keep me alive.
Oh, my God, like locked-in syndrome.
Absolutely. In fact, ironically, I'd just given the book, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, to a friend the day before I went to Afghanistan.
No, please. No, unreal.
I'd given them that book because I'd read it just before I went away, was really moved by it, and then obviously injured in Afghanistan, then put into induced coma, flown back to the UK. I'm in Birmingham Hospital. I wake up, and I wanted to scream. You know, I didn't know where I was. I knew I was in a hospital, it was bright lights, people running around, but I had no idea even what country. I knew I'd been injured, I knew what had happened, but I didn't know anything apart from that. So I tried to scream and I realized that I had tubes in my mouth, that in my throat, it was all cut into my throat. There was no way I could speak. I tried to move my one remaining hand, but it had been broken, so it was in a plaster cast and strapped to the bed. I realized I was strapped to the bed, I couldn't move. It soon became apparent to me that the only bodily function I had any control over was blinking. And I tried blinking for a while. Nobody even noticed. I don't know how long, but I think a day before anyone even realized that I was conscious again trying to communicate. And then the only way that I could communicate for most of that period was by blinking. So, you know, two occasions my family was calling to say goodbye and I could just blink at them. But the funny side of it is, you know, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly is such a beautiful book about, you know, somebody in lockdown syndrome trying to write a book. And there's also a beautiful film about it, and the film is very kind of this beautiful French film, and his kind of speech therapist develops an alphabet for him that uses the most commonly used letters at the beginning, so it's easier to use. And she kind of uses her finger, then he blinks when he wants to say the word. I had amazing staff, but you know they were on an NHS budget, so I had this little really badly photocopied alphabet, which had like I remember it had a big coffee stain on it, and it was so small I couldn't even really read it. And I'd be trying to do it, and then they would get, you know, we'd be halfway through a word, and then somebody would shout something at them, and they'd turn around, and they'd go, what were you saying again? And we'd start again. But it was incredibly difficult. And what's interesting, I mean, we went through, obviously, a lot of people through lockdown. I say this was ultimate lockdown. I basically was existing in my own mind. That was my world. I had nothing outside of that. I had no senses, because you're not eating. I mean, I didn't eat for 46 days. Because it's all in tubes. I couldn't touch anything. That was one of the worst things. I had no physical touch because my hand was in a cast and I'd lost my other limbs. I had no input. There was nothing. No smells, no sounds because there's stuff, you know, I had nothing.
Just your brain.
Yeah. And so at first it was like being thrown in the freezing cold ocean and you're like in a panic, but you can't do anything about it. It's like in a dream where you're screaming, but you can't get out of it. And then I realized I was going to have to kind of control something and create some kind of world for myself. And so I used to do all sorts of activities and create a universe. And one of them was a project called 100 Portraits Before I Die. And I imagined the 100 people I wished I'd done portraits of. And it was a very eclectic mix. I mean, I was on morphine. So, you know, it was a kind of mixture of everything from, you know, Jean-Paul Belmondo and Jean-Luc Godard to Kermit the Frog. I mean, it was just anybody that had influence in my life in some way. But I would imagine these photo shoots.
And how you would light them.
Exactly. Visualized every detail, like meeting the person, how we talked, what camera I'd use, you know, would we do it outside, location, studio. And then at the end, I would see the photograph and then imagine what I could do differently. And so if I look at the way I worked before I got injured and afterwards, everything changed from the cameras, the fact I went back to film, the lighting, everything changed in that process. So I believe that even locked down in our own mind, we can change ourselves and improve ourselves as creative people, because that's the one thing that can't be taken away from us is our imagination and our creativity. And you do have to create your own discipline and own world. And sorry, I sidetracked myself slightly, but the thing I was going to say is then I got, that was after 46 days, I got then moved to a high dependency unit. Then I have to deal with something different, which is the reality of being told, look, you're probably never going to walk again. You may not live independently, because my one remaining hand was so smashed to pieces, they'd rebuilt it with metal plates. You know, I was still being fed at that stage. And, you know, as somebody that's traveled the world, been so independent, so virulently kind of like from age of 14, 15, not wanting anybody to tell me what to do, suddenly I can't even decide when I go to the toilet. And 3 months after was the first time they could transfer me. They had four people, had to slide me across into a wheelchair for the first time out of the bed to have a shower. And I saw myself in a mirror. And I remember just being shocked, really. It was like a moment of sort of reality, because everything else had sort of been in my mind at that point. Suddenly I'm seeing myself, you know, missing limbs. And when they put me back to bed, I just cried myself to sleep thinking, well, I can't, I don't want to be this person. I'm not strong enough. I'm strong enough to survive, but I'm not strong enough to live as somebody with disability. I don't want to be cared for. I don't want to be that person. But the next morning I woke up and that stubbornness had kicked back. And this is the long answer to your question, but I woke up the next day and I said, from this moment on, I will never think about the things I can't do, but I'll focus on what I can and I will excel at that. And, you know, some people have said to me, oh, it's important for you to think about the things you can't do and get over that. I said, well, for me, the way my brain works, no. And so that's when it came to photography. It's like, I didn't think about the fact I can't run around, I can't jump, I can't get weird angles, I can't do that. I never think about it. But what I know I can do is I can stand and do somebody's portrait and I can do it better than anybody else because of my connection with that person that's unique to me. And so that was always the point, that from then onwards I'd focus. And maybe even if I'm working in a place like in Ukraine where I've been working where it is more active and there's things going on, but I work in a different way now. So I tend to watch rhythms of a place and I see what happens in a place each day. And then I make sure I'm sat in the right place for the next day and think about it in a different way and not get frustrated by the things I can't do because I'm so focused on what I can.
Exactly. I make my point, the point I made at the beginning, the positivity and the optimism. Only an incredibly sort of strong, positive person could not go down the hill completely.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, there are moments when you know, all these things are never... But as I say, I look at my life now and I don't think I've ever been in a position where I'm doing all the things I've ever dreamt of doing. I'm happy with the work I'm doing. I'm achieving things I set out to do. And so that's what I focus on.
Well, you've turned it to huge advantage. And in a sense, it's turned a spotlight on your work. And through your work, you've set up this incredible charity, The Legacy of War, and you've managed to turn your subjects into storytellers themselves, haven't you? Shift the power dynamic.
Well, again, I think that was the really important thing for me is why was I making photographs? What was it I actually hoped to achieve? And, you know, for me personally, it was because I hoped to have some kind of positive impact. And I realized that I would be doing photographs and going back and meeting families 2-3 years later and nothing had changed. And kind of going, well, is it enough then just to keep taking photographs and giving them to a magazine and everyone kind of patting me on the back? And it wasn't. And so I was like, well, how can I actually start to create real change? I believe stories have incredible power. I think we live in a time where, you know, people say to me, oh, photojournalism's dead now, you can't make a living from it, and all those things. I believe that traditional format of photojournalism is dead because, unfortunately, the magazines don't have budgets and you can't send photographers away for 6 months on a good budget. But something else is coming that's very exciting, and that is the ability to really impact the people who you photograph directly. So it started on a very simple level of Syrian families in Lebanon. There was one particular story of a woman called Khulud, who I met in 2014. And she had been shot by a sniper at home in Syria. And she actually fell on top of her children. She was in the garden. You know, horrific story of this young mother getting emergency treatment and then being taken to Lebanon. And when I met her in the Bekaa Valley, she was living with her family in a homemade tent. You know, literally bits of plastic cardboard and posters ripped down from billboards. And, you know, this incredibly bright, positive person, but paralyzed from the neck down, lying in a bed that she couldn't have a window even, and just that was her life. And I made a photograph of her with her husband Jamal, and he sort of sat at the end holding her hand. And I remember asking her, what's your one hope for the future? And she said, I just want to be a mother again. Because she says, it's so hard for me. The children are outside playing. And if I hear one of them fall over, I can't go and help them. And so she was incredibly positive, but you could see and feel the pain inside her. So I made that photograph. And it was an important point for me because it was one of the first times I was traveling after my own injuries, traveling independently and working. And I related, obviously, having spent a year in hospital myself, what it was like to be trapped.
Incarcerated, yeah.
So I went back 2 years later and I was tracking down a lot of the families that I'd met on that previous trip, because there were other families in similar situations that I had documented. And I got a phone call from Jamal, who's the husband of Khalood, saying, you know, we hear you're back, we'd love to see you. And I remember saying, well, where are you now? And he said, well, we're in the same place. And I hadn't even bothered to look for them there because those pictures have been published around the world. You know, I'd done lots of talks showing those photographs. And I just assumed that would mean something happened. Maybe that's naive, but that was also my belief. And so I went to see them the next day, and I walked into the tent, and I burst into tears because I saw Khalood lying in the same bed where she had not moved for 2 years since I last saw her, with no windows. It's like in the winter, it's like a freezer. In the summer, it's like an oven. And she just smiled, and she said, it's okay, because we knew you'd come back. And, you know, that's the kind of person she is. And I thought, well, okay, I just have to do the story again. I have to, you know, do better photographs. But I have to do something different at the end of it. And so I spent the week photographing the family. And it's an incredibly hard to explain, but you feel very uplifted every time you've been in that place, even though it's hellish, because of who she is and the family. And Jamal, the husband, I mean, he's lost everything. You know, he's lost a lot of his family in Syria, his home. And he has this tiny little kitchen on the side of this tent. And he'll cook. He's a really good cook. And he'll whisper to me his greatest fear. And if you imagine this man who's lost everything, his greatest fear. And he's learned to even say it in English now. And he'll say to me, Giles, he goes, my greatest fear is that Khalood does not love me as much as I love her. And it's so beautiful. And so I had the photograph that I'd taken 2 years before of them sat on the bed. And I normally take photographs back if I can. But on this case, I wasn't sure about giving it to them because nothing had changed. It was literally the same photograph 2 years later. They were sat there talking. I had the photograph in my bag. But when I did give it to them, you know, I said to Khalood, when I took this photograph, it was not a photograph of a woman with a disability. It was not a photograph of a woman living, you know, as a refugee. This was a photograph of a couple in love with each other. And that's the moment I realized that I'm not a war photographer, because I don't photograph tanks, planes, explosions. I photograph couples, and I photograph people. You know, I photograph a grandmother brushing granddaughter's hair, mother feeding a baby, a father on the floor doing lessons with his kids. And I realized that that's what I wanted to share. And that's when we set up the NGO, because I said, all we're going to do is we're going to share stories and see how people respond. And so we set up a crowdfunding campaign. We had some friends who are actors and high profiles who just shared that story. And we raised $250,000 in 2 weeks. And so we were able to rehouse Khalood and her family and many, many other families. And that was the beginning for me of the transition of going, wow, I have these photographs. I have these stories. And people want to help. And all I have to do is set up the vehicle for them to be able to do that, and then we can create real and positive change.
But she became one of your patrons, didn't she, then?
Well, we made Khalood one of our patrons. She was in Holland now. I wanted to, when we set up this charity, I wanted to also do things differently. You know, it's like there's a lot of amazing charities out there. I still work with a lot of them. But I thought if I was going to do it, here was an opportunity to have a clean slate and to look at some of the things and the challenges that I saw in NGOs. And so one thing was immediately patrons. I was like, well, patrons should be the people you're working with. You know, let's put them in a position where they're actually helping to set the agenda of how we work as an organization. We have a project called Land for Women in Rwanda, which is unique because we have cooperative farms for genocide survivors and survivors of sexual violence. And so there are other cooperatives for women, but what we do is we buy the land. Then the land is put into the ownership of the women. So they have the power dynamic where they choose to work with us now, which completely changes an NGO. So we have a 5-year training program. We help them to learn about everything from banking to organic farming, to climate smart use of the land. But they can tell us to get lost if they want, because it's their land. And we have great relationships with them. And now we've seen some of the first farms, they've graduated, they're on their own, and now they're helping us to train the next set of farms. So we're able to change that power dynamic. We're setting up a system so that all our core funding, so to run like the actual charity itself, comes from private donors and events, so that when people donate, 100% goes to the countries. We have no international staff. My whole team all gets paid the same as me. We all get paid the national average wage. You know, we're trying to do things differently. And that for me is, again, that sense of purpose where the opportunity came to do something, but also the opportunity to do it in a unique way.
That's very unusual, isn't it? They get to tell their own story and drive their own story, write it.
And I mean, we're also, as an organization, I'm able now to commission photographers who are not me. So our project in Rwanda, I just got an amazing photographer called Alice, who is a Rwandan female photographer, and I commissioned her to do the story. You know, it'd be easier for me to do it in the sense of budgets, but I'm like, it's important we're also supporting local photographers to tell the stories. So it's a lovely place for me to be, something I never imagined. You know, the kid at 14, 15 that didn't open his A-levels, I never thought I'd be a CEO of a charity that's sort of growing. But it's enabled me to set some of the wrongs that I've seen in the sector and try things differently.
Yes, become the campaigner that you are. So you definitely do believe in the power of a photograph to change lives, to make a difference.
So if I look at that picture that I did of Khaloud and Jamal sitting there holding hands, that photograph directly led to us raising $250,000. It's led to the forming of a charity. And I think, you know, it's very hard for people when you say, you know, there's X millions displays, there's this in Ukraine. But when you tell those individual stories, I think people can relate to it. And I think also people are overwhelmed, and we've got to be aware of that. You know, I think people have said to me that people are disengaged now. I think it's the opposite. You know, I think especially the young generation through social media are overwhelmed by how much is going on in the world. It's hard to take it all in because, you know, when I was young, we watched the 9 o'clock news, and you might get the serious stuff on that. And the rest of the time that you weren't around it, I'm to myself, I wake up in the morning and I'm checking my Instagram and I'm being overwhelmed by really difficult stories and it's constant. And so then for people feel like I can't do anything about it, the problems are so big. When you take it down to families and you say, look, I wish I could do more about Ukraine, but we can definitely help this particular family. You know, they've escaped with two children with disabilities. They lost their wheelchairs. We can replace those wheelchairs. Let's do that. People then feel I can do something and be engaged. And so a lot of our big campaigns, we've raised, you know, $250,000 or $300,000 in crowdfunding, but most of the donations have been $5 or $10. And they're because people feel part of a community, and then we're able to tell the stories and share the family's experiences afterwards. And that, for me, means people feel that they are part of solving, not the problem, but part of solving individuals' and families' challenges.
Yeah, so you can start small, but have a huge seismic...
Exactly.
Make a huge seismic difference in something. I really wanted to talk to you about also... the other frontline work that you've done, the NHS in the pandemic, that was also quite...
Yeah. Actually, that was really interesting because that changed also how we are as a foundation. The charity changed because up to that point, I had been very much about individual stories, like if I was doing something where I photographed a family, we'd help that family. When COVID hit, obviously I'm stuck at home, so I wasn't traveling so much. I had a really crazy year the year before where I'd kind of pushing myself beyond what was normal. I mean, I remember in 1 month, I think it was September before COVID, I had a burst appendix as I was getting on a flight to Laos. Literally was saved because if I got on that flight, who knows what would have happened. Discharged myself from hospital, went to South Sudan, got malaria. Again, didn't take time off. It was relentless. And so when COVID hit, suddenly I had a moment to sit back and think strategically about what we were doing. So it actually started my experience in COVID with the charity because I thought, well, we should do some things to help. You know, we have a structure, and so, you know, what can we do? And I live in Hastings, and I have friends there who work in the NHS. And one of my friends, she's a sister at the hospital. And I rang her up and I said, look, I know you're under so much strain. What's the one thing, you know, apart from PPE and all those things, what else can we do? And she said, well, transport's a real problem because all the buses have stopped. We've got a lot of nurses who have come in from other areas. Transportation's a real problem. I was like, I'm sure we can find a way to set up a volunteer taxi service. Now, my dear friend put up, before I'd arranged anything, she put up on the wall going, if you're struggling to get home, ring this number, and put my mobile number on there. So I started getting phone calls at like 3 a.m. from nurses going, I've just finished my shift, I need to get home. They didn't know it was just an individual. I felt guilty, so I just booked my taxi and paid for it myself. So it started like that. In the end, I did get volunteer drivers, and we did over, I think, 1,000 free taxi journeys. But every single one of those bookings came through my phone. So my phone was going constantly through that whole period. And then soon after that as well, I got a phone call from Shihen Hetarachi, who was the surgeon that did most of the surgery saving my life, who is head of accident emergency at Imperial. And he said, look, would you come and document what's happening with COVID, our response? And what was really interesting is there was a lot of pushback about allowing photographers to come in and document it.
Why?
I think government, because obviously this is when the PPE thing was happening. They maybe didn't want to see people, the response within it. I'm not sure what it was. Even within the Imperial Healthcare Trust, there were people saying, from one side of it, not the medical side, the other side, the admin saying, we're not going to allow photographers in. But the medical side was saying, look, this is also historic for us. So in the end, it was agreed that I could go in there and kind of be the resident photographer. And we said, why don't we just do the photographs and we can decide if we're going to use them later. But at least we have them here on record. I will sort of, promise not to publish them anywhere, but let's just do it. And so, suddenly I found myself. And that was really interesting because I was back in intensive care wards around some of the surgeons, doctors, anaesthetists, nurses that actually saved my life, which is why they'd asked me to come and do it. It brought back a lot of trauma at first, because even being in intensive care wards and just hearing the bleeps and the noises. But again, what it did was give me an insight into, I know what it's like being in that situation. And it's the small little details of how, these incredible NHS staff, even under that huge pressure they were under, even if somebody was in an induced coma, how they would hold that person's hand when they were talking to them. Little details of care that probably I was connected to and maybe somebody else wouldn't have seen. It was a really interesting thing. It was funny, though. My sister rang me up about 3 weeks into COVID, and she said, it's so nice. She said, finally, I can go to sleep knowing you're safe at home. And then she was like, what's that noise in the background? It's kind of bleeping. And I was like, nothing. She says, where are you? And I said, well, I'm in the COVID ward.
Were you there for 3 weeks?
I was there for a couple of months on and off. So, going in and out. And I was very privileged and grateful to have done it and in some small ways sort of paying back to a lot of the staff that had helped me.
And what happened to those photographs? They were published in GQ.
Yeah, GQ, and then there was a historical record, so they've been bought by a couple of museums to keep them on as their record.
And Giles, I mean, you talk about the trauma quite a lot, and you seem a remarkably sane person to me. What helps keep you sane, in fact?
I think it's firstly understanding sometimes that it's normal to have trauma and memories. It's learning to be better at knowing when they're getting too much. I mean, I was in, just before Christmas, I was in Ukraine, not far away from Bakhmut, where the really bad fighting is, and between Kramatorsk, and they're in military hospitals. And the amount of casualties coming in is just unbelievable. It's like, hard to explain. Because it is like scenes from World War One or World War Two, these huge hospitals and just ambulance after ambulance and ambulance. And of course, for me, that was actually the first time I'd been back in military hospital since my injury and seeing, men coming in stretchers and having all their clothes cutting off. And it was exactly what happened to me. And it's definitely started to trigger some trauma. It was less, obviously you could hear the artillery and all the fighting going on, but it was seeing that and seeing how, somebody's gone so white because they're dying and seeing a lot of men dying who were injured like I was. But I knew I was becoming like snappy with my team. I was not sleeping. I was having very bad nightmares. I just know to step away at that point. I'm like, now I need to take some time off. In the past, I would have tried to push through it. I would have almost seen it as, oh, come on, you just need to be stronger, push through it. Now I kind of go, it's understandable. You're in exactly the same environment as when you got injured. Of course, it's going to remind you of the trauma, but you have to step back a bit, give yourself some healing, give yourself some time, and go back to it. So I would say I'm lucky in the sense of course, there's trauma from what happened, but it's never been outside of when I'm working in that environment. So when I come home and I do rest up, it does start to ease.
Because in the past, you have pushed yourself incredibly hard, as if you're trying to prove something to yourself.
No, less proving something to myself but other people, because you know, when you get injured and you have a disability, everyone assumes what you can and can't do, and everybody will pigeonhole you in being less capable of doing things. And so actually, you know, even I was talking to a member of my team in the charity, and we were saying, it's funny, before Christmas, you know, I worked relentlessly last year. But if I turn around to say somebody else and say, oh, I'm exhausted, they kind of go, well, it's not surprising with your injuries, or not surprised. Well, it's got nothing to do with that, because anybody would be suffering the same way. But people kind of will always see that and think, oh, it's because of that. And so for me, for a long time, it was I would have to prove myself on every trip I went. Everything I did, I would push myself harder than anyone else, because I didn't want to be seen as the perceived weak link, or I didn't want to be seen as the person that needed extra support or extra help. You know, when you go into conflict areas, it's hard. People, you know, it's difficult work. You don't want to be thinking of, because I would see it sometimes, you know, you turn up and people could almost be going, oh, it's going to be more of a liability than a help. And so I would always not allow people to help me in any way. And that's eased a bit now, because I'm more comfortable with it, and also other people I work with understand that I am capable of doing everything. But yeah, I think it was more about pushing myself to prove to other people than to myself.
Yeah, the pigeonholing is very irritating, isn't it? I mean, and that's the problem, isn't it, with the news, the media, is that it portrays, everybody is portrayed as two-dimensional. And I suppose that's why you particularly went into the food side of your cooking, your...
Yeah, the one-armed chef started partly because, you know, I would go to a restaurant and I might be on a date and my food would come out all cut up into pieces.
Mm. And shocking.
But it's hard because, especially at the beginning when you're coming to terms with it yourself, it's like when I go to a hotel, I'll often be booked into a wheelchair-accessible room, even though I'm not using a wheelchair, because it's just disability is one thing. And at first, you know, you don't want to make a fuss. So if somebody's cut up your food, they're like, in your mind, you're thinking, well, they're trying to be helpful. So I don't want to make a fuss. I don't want to be the one being awkward. Now that's changed. And I would just say to somebody, look, I'm sorry, but I didn't ask for my food to be cut up. And it spoiled, you know, the way it looked and everything. And it's funny because people get quite defensive and they go, but you've got one arm. And so I started to take photographs of the food I was cooking at home. And then I would say, well, show this to your chef, because I don't think he would be able to do this with two hands. And there's been a couple of times where I've ended up going in the kitchen and doing a food challenge with the chef, kind of half as a joke, because I want to show people that perception of, you know, my greatest disability is in the eyes of others, because they've made an assumption about what I can and can't do. And so, yes, you're cutting up my food, but you've actually destroyed that meal for me. Especially, like, you know, if you're on a date or something, you've been infantile. You know, you look like a child. They made all, you know, your food like that. And so, for me, it started about cooking things one-handed. And I have nothing adapted in my kitchen. You know, I can cook anywhere in the same way. I would say I wasn't going to have anything adapted. I would have to adapt. And so, that's kind of how it started. But also, food was therapy for me, from coming back from conflicts, because I realized that food is the antithesis of war, because where war destroys, breaks communities apart, and is an expression of hatred, food is about bringing people together, community, and how we show love. And it's the balance in my life that when, as you were saying earlier about how do you cope with that trauma, I cook, I bring friends around, we eat together. That is the balance that I need to remind me of another world. Because I think sometimes, you know, if you're in conflict zones a lot and you see that brutality, you just kind of give up hope on humanity. And then you come back and you actually share some food with friends, and you or even in the conflict zones, you eat together and you cook. That reminds you of the other side of it. And then that also led on then with the one-armed chef to wanting to do, you know, TV stuff with it. Because again, you know, I found that too often when you go to a conflict zone and if somebody's filming it, everything becomes about all the intensity and the the darkness of war, which of course is important, that's part of it, but you missed the laughter, you missed the shared meals, the humanity. And that's surely what we're trying to say is people in that situation. And that's where we relate to people. It's very hard to relate to people screaming in a street because their house has just been bombed. But you can relate to the family that's sitting around in a darkened room, even if it's you know, damaged by bullet holes, eating a meal. I mean, it's a great way as well for me to build relationships. There's a good story about when it first really became part of the way I work, when I was doing a story in Mosul, coming to the end of the fighting there. And that was, you know, brutal, brutal conflict and really hard to connect with people. And I was taken to meet a family by an NGO, and they said, you know, you should meet this grandmother. And this house had been on the front lines between ISIS and the Iraqi coalition. And so the house was like a kind of TV set from a Tom Hanks war film, you know, blackened walls and bullet holes in the windows. And the grandmother comes to the door and she's screaming at me about what had happened. And it was obviously the trauma was coming through her, and it was I was trying to calm her down. I said, you don't need to tell me everything. But essentially what had happened is the father of the family had been on the roof collecting water, and he had been killed by a drone strike. Then the grandfather had been out in the garden and a mortar had landed there and killed him. And eventually the mother had been killed while she was cooking by a sniper. Mm. And it had taken her 2 or 3 days to die, but they couldn't move her because they were under fighting. There was still blood on the floor from that kitchen. It was just horrendous. So it was just the grandmother left with 3 or 4 grandchildren. And as I say, she was screaming at me. And that's the normal kind of response because it's a journalist and they're trying to tell the story, but also it was just really uncomfortable. And I said to her, actually, I said, I've just come to meet you and I'd love to cook with you. And she kind of looked for a second and then just carried on. And I said to my translator, I said, please, can you ask her to sit down? We sat down. I said, look, my grandmother was Italian. She taught me to cook, but she's no longer with us. I said, I need a new grandmother. And you could see her kind of doing this double take, like, why is this guy with one arm come halfway around the world to the middle of Mosul in the fighting to cook with me? But it was enough to give her a pause as well from what she was saying. And she smiled and she said, okay, come back tomorrow. And I went back the next day. All I could find in Mosul at the time was like a frozen chicken and some rice. And it turned out she's the worst cook I've ever met. I mean, she was terrible. And it turned out her reticence, and she had been a bit unsure, is more because she was embarrassed about how bad she was cooking. And so we spent the first half an hour trying to get this frozen chicken in a pot, which wouldn't fit, hitting it with hammers, like chicken shrapnel flying around the room. But we spent the day like laughing and cooking in the kitchen. The grandchildren were there. And it was like a moment of respite for everybody. And then we sat down and we ate together and we shared some stories. And then one of her other sons, who hadn't seen her for 3-4 years because it'd been under ISIS control, arrived, and he broke into tears when he saw her there eating a meal. And that's the power of food. You know, food is that moment where all of us get respite from our traumas. I know when I was in hospital, that was my highlight of the day, when I was able to eat.
You turned from a vegan into a meat-eating carnivore.
Yeah, well, I was a vegetarian from when I left home, so sort of 17, 18, until I was in hospital at 38. And I'd always missed meat. It was an ethical reason for doing it. And, yeah, I hadn't eaten. I mean, 46 days I was fed by tube, so I hadn't tasted anything for 46 days. And they took the tubes out, and I could still only have liquid food for quite a while. So I hadn't really eaten food for 3 months. And then they said, right, you can try eating again. And so my sister, who is a really good cook, she was like, well, what can I get you? You know, do you want a tofu burger or a corn burger? Or... and she'd always kind of slightly shrugged her shoulders at Christmases and things when you know, I had to have a nut roast and everyone else had turkey. And I just looked at her and I said, just get me a steak. Don't bother cooking it. and I think it was just, yeah, that thing of your body telling you something. And but it was interesting because as a cook, I had never even cooked meat until I was 40.
So were you a cook before?
I'd always enjoyed it.
You had an Italian grandmother, as you said.
Italian grandmother. And also my mother was, because my mother had me later in life, so she was brought up in London in the 1930s. And she was a Cockney, and proper Cockney, and was sent out to work in a stately home as a cook at 14, 15.
Wow.
So she was probably kind of Downton Abbey thing where she turned up and she was told first job was skin a rabbit and cook it, and she'd never even seen a rabbit.
Goodness.
But it meant that she brought me up. I didn't realize it at the time, but where everything was homemade. It was like suet puddings, kedgeree, you know, spotted dick, all those traditional things, because that's how she had learned as a cook in a stately home. So everything was always homemade. Everything was, I just thought that was normal. And she didn't really teach me as such, but obviously that osmosis of being around it all the time. But the values of cooking like that, I think, is something that intrinsically has now impacted me as a chef.
Pretty impressed in your one-arm chef in Jura, watching you tuck into a huge crab, the biggest crab I've ever seen in that car in the rain with your one hand. That was pretty impressive. I have to. You devoured the whole thing.
I mean, that's the thing. I don't even really think about it anymore. And you know, I was in Italy years ago in Milan, and I'd gone there to do a shoot and got there late. And I was trying to find something to eat. I found a little restaurant, but they'd sort of stopped serving. And I was like, oh, you know, there's going to be nowhere else open, so I'll just stay and have a drink. And it ended up becoming, you know, late night shots with the owners and a couple of other people there. And at about 3 a.m, I broke into his kitchen and started making pasta. And the owner comes in and like screaming at me, but then saw what I was doing and let me finish. And I was making egg yolk ravioli, which is like ravioli with an egg yolk in it with one hand. And he was saying, I can't do this. And I never think about it that, oh, it's amazing you did it with one hand. It's just no choice. You do it with one hand. I mean, so I've learned and adapted to do everything like that. And that's stubbornness. That's not positivity. There's a difference. You know, positivity is saying, oh, I'm sure I can do this. I'm more like, there's no way I'm not going to be able to do this.
Positivity is also seeing the good side. I mean, you've seen some pretty terrible stuff, and yet you still believe in the innate goodness of people.
Yeah, because the reality is, in most cases, what you're seeing is yes, the violence, you know, mainly carried out by men, by military, but because I'm with families, you know, and in many ways, when a family has lost everything, it's distilled down into the core values of love and support. And, you know, a family living in a refugee camp or in a war zone is totally reliant on each other. And you see that desperation to protect, to look after the children. You know, that you see the fathers, the mothers, all they want is their children to be safe, to be looked after. And really, that's the core values of love. And in some ways, you don't see that so much in the West because everyone's worried about their careers and everything else becomes, of course, it is there, but we get caught up with all these other distractions. When everything's taken away, you see actually humanity in its purest sense.
Yes, that's true.
And what's important. And so actually, that's what gives me the strength to do what I do.
Well, on that note, may you carry on doing what you do for a very long time to come. And I think you're off to give yet another. I think you're one of the most followed people on TED Talks, actually.
Yeah, I mean, speaking is really interesting because, again, I think I just see it as storytelling. And so for me, I say I'll go to all these difficult places so I can come back and share stories. And that, for me, is actually the joy in what I do. So, yeah, off to Glasgow to do another story.
Well, I love listening to your stories, and thank you so much for coming to us.
No, absolute pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Voices from the Frontline. The podcast is hosted by me, Catherine Fairweather. If you enjoy the podcast, please do leave us an honest review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast, as your reviews help us to reach a wider audience. Alternatively, if you'd like to provide detailed feedback or have a guest recommendation, please email media@frontline.com.